Welcome to today's teleclass. My name is Julie Storr. I'm hosting the teleclass. I'm the Vice President of the Infection Prevention Society of the UK and Ireland. And it's an absolute pleasure and an honour, in fact, to introduce today's speaker, Professor Peter Pronovost, to the Weber training class, which is sponsored by Virox Technologies today. Now, many of you will be aware of Peter's work and the fact that he is an intensivist at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore, and he's also Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, amongst a number of other designations. Today, Peter will be talking to us about eliminating central line-associated bloodstream infections, CLABSI, a model for reducing preventable harm. And I'd like to hand over to Peter for what's going to be a very informative teleclass and give a warm welcome from everybody who's listening today. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you, Julie. It's great to hear your voice. Julie and I worked together for a while at WHO, and it's an honor to be with you today. This technology doesn't allow for conversation, so for good or for bad, you're going to have to put up with listening to me for about the next 50, 55 minutes. And I want to just give you an outline of the ride that we're going to go on. We'll first just lay the landscape very briefly of what we've accomplished in safety. I will then tell a story of how we eliminated bloodstream infections, in part through the use of checklist, in part through a broader culture intervention, and then broaden the lens back out to say, what are some of the generalizable lessons we learned, not just for bloodstream infections, but for reducing other types of infections and other types of preventable harm. So I think you'll walk away with this with a fairly specific interventions that you might be able to do. I'm on the I will slide, and I wonder if each of you in your seats could write down the words I will. And at the end of this session, I will ask you to complete that sentence. You see, I believe deeply that the impact from these types of conferences aren't that you only learn something or you perhaps get inspired. It's that you actually do something, because this issue of patient safety and preventable harm is an enormous problem. And it's frighteningly a problem that we've made very, very little progress in now. Over the last decade, we've been talking about patient safety an awful lot and doing an awful lot, but there's been several reports suggesting that the empiric evidence that patient outcomes have been broadly improved is very limited. There's a recent study in the BMJ showing maybe there's some reductions in the UK. There's some of our work on bloodstream infections, but outside of that, we haven't really made much of a dent in what patients care about. What we care about is that is patient outcomes. And you know, I look at the side of wrong site surgery, and you know, a layperson might look at these data, and you could substitute wrong site surgery for any other sentinel event. The curves all look the same, and conclude that our efforts are exceedingly effective at causing wrong site surgery. Exceedingly effective. Now, I don't think that's the case, and we really don't know why it's going up. It's likely reporting bias. But I do know that we made policy for this with pretty limited understanding of the problem. We didn't really delve into it scientifically to find out really why clinicians were working the way they did. We made national policy with no pilot testing if this program worked, and we made national policy with no real measurement system. And that kind of what I might call unscientific approach, or an approach that's just frustrated by the harm and looking to go do something quick. And these quick fixes approach haven't worked, probably not surprisingly, because the way our work system evolved, over time, clinicians who care deeply, very deeply, kind of jerry-rigged and put together systems that they hoped could defend against harm in admittedly often myopic ways, but simple solutions I don't think are really going to be the answer. At least they haven't been thus far. This is complicated stuff. And if I think about how I would describe the last decade of working in quality, I'm reminded by this quote from Rusty Schumpeter. Rusty was a U.S. astronaut in one of the pre-lunar missions and was interviewed when he was flying over the Middle East and asked what it looked like. You know, given what's going on today in the Middle East, it's so poignant. Rusty said, "What I noticed is that there's no lines in outer space. We invent them. They're figments of our imagination. And yet on Earth, we kill people over those imaginary lines." Right? And I think about what the fields of patient safety and quality have done, and I see a whole lot of lines. At a global level, I see lines. At a country level, there's often many different agencies telling you different, often contradictory things that, as a clinician, your head's spinning. There's state or trust level variations that are telling us different things to do. And then within our provider organizations, infection prevention is often separated from clinicians and risk and executives, collectively spending a lot of money, but not really moving the dime. So I see these efforts that have been independent rather than interdependent, efforts that have been competitive rather than cooperative, and efforts that have been far, far too focused on what we do rather than the results that we achieve. Now, I want to share you the story of how we tackled central line-associated bloodstream infections, what we'll call CLABSI, or I may just call BSI because it's shorter on the phone, but no, that's what we're referring to. And you'll hear in our story this commitment, this dedication to rigorously measure infections, at least to the extent possible. Now, I wish I could say that that mission began nobly. It was grew out of some scientific endeavor, but the sad reality is it didn't. It grew out pretty ignobly because this little girl died at my hospital from a catheter infection, or what started as a catheter infection and then led to a cascade of other errors. And her mother, a remarkable woman, Sorrell, has been working with us, and on the four-year anniversary of her daughter's death, she looked at me and said, "Peter, could you tell me that Josie's less likely to die today than she was 4 years ago?" And I suspect, like you, my hands got sweaty, I became really uncomfortable, and I started telling her all the stuff we're doing, and it was a lot of stuff. But there was no strategy, and God knows there was no measurement, and so she cut me off and said, "Peter, I don't really care what you're doing. That's your job. I want to know, is care safer, and how do you know?" And the reality, the sad reality, is I couldn't give her an answer, and I believe she deserves one, and that only comes with rigorous measurement. So that theme for this hearing isn't going to be a pointy academic. It's because I think we have an obligation to our patients to answer for every one of them, that really haunting question, am I safer? So this little girl dies of an infection at my hospital. Now, at the time, our rates of catheter infections were somewhere between 11 and 15 per thousand catheter days. And those of you who know that, that is, at least I believe now, outrageously high, unacceptably high. But at the time, I was one of those docs working in the ICU. I certainly didn't want to kill people, let alone a little girl who looks like my daughter. And we're Johns Hopkins, right? We're treating sick patients. These things happen. These infections are inevitable. And it was what is so common in healthcare, well-intentioned clinicians who are individually accountable for a piece of the work, but nobody was accountable really for the overall results. So we went to the Centers for Disease Control guidelines, a guideline in the U.S. that is elegant, that is scholarly, but that is often useless for me at the bedside because it recommends somewhere between 90 and 100 things, and it's nearly 200 pages. And as a busy clinician, I'm lucky I could do three things, let alone 90. So we went to the guideline and called out five evidence-based practices to try to prevent these infections. Those practices are wash your hands, clean your skin with chlorhexidine, avoid the femoral site, use full barrier precautions, and ask every day if I still need this catheter. Now, you, maybe you are infection preventionists, know that those things aren't rocket science, but we worded them as a checklist in and they're behaviorally specific. Why do we do that? Well, a couple reasons. One is there's some really good data that shows that clinicians don't think in conditional probabilities or if-then statements. So formatting guidelines as these long conditional probabilities, no wonder why no one uses it. There's good data that our brains don't work that way. Two, we also learned that ambiguity is one of the main reasons why clinicians don't comply with guidelines. So I suspect you can go to most of the policies in your hospital, including mine, and read them, and you would be hard-pressed to walk away saying, I'm crystal clear about who has to do what, where, when, and how. In other words, they're not behaviorally specific. So we made these, as you can see, they're all worded as verbs, or they're all verbs worded very explicitly about the behaviors that we wanted. So we looked, and we were doing those things 30% of the time. So I was doing those things 30% of the time. And I didn't want to do that, but simply making a checklist wasn't going to be enough. So we went and found out, well, what were the barriers to us using those things all the time? Why was I only using it 30% of the time? And what we found was fascinating. We found initially that our docs had to go to 8 different places to get all the equipment to comply with this checklist. Caps were in one place, masks were in another, gowns were in yet another. Half the time they weren't stocked. And when things weren't stocked, our doctors, including myself, made the conscious decision, an economic decision, to say, is it worth me running down the hall to get this, which means I'm going to spend 10 minutes less with another patient, or just go without it? And the logic often defaults to, well, the time I'm not going to spend with other patients is very real. The infections are often delayed and invisible and distant, so clinicians naturally cut the corner. They say, I don't have time to go do this. I'm just going to go without it. And so what we did was get a line cart, took 8 steps down to 1, assigned someone to stock it, so we made it easy for doctors. Compliance went up from 30% to 75% with the checklist. Infection rates came down from 11 to 5. Good, but still not good enough. So I pulled the doctors and the nurses together and said, is it tenable that we harm patients here at Johns Hopkins? And everyone said, oh, of course not, Peter. No, of course we can't. And I said, and do you agree that the items on this checklist are evidence-based, that everyone ought to get them all the time? Yes, Peter, they're from the CDC. They're evidence-based. Absolutely, you should get them. I said, okay, well, we're not doing it all the time now. We're only doing it 75% of the time. So nurses, I would like you to assist our doctors when they go to place these catheters. And if the doctors don't comply with the checklist, nurses, you are empowered to stop takeoff. That is, you can make them go back and fix the defect. So it was still using a checklist, but now instead of a kind of one person doing it, what's called an internal read or a read back, we now have a second user coming in and interacting with this clinician to make sure that they're actually using this checklist. Well, when I proposed this idea, I almost caused World War III in our ICUs. It was literally a revolt. The nurses first said, it's not my job to police the doctors, and if I do, I'm going to get my head bit off. And unfortunately, they were right, and often around the globe are still right. The doctor said, Peter, you can't have the nurses questioning me in public. It makes me look like I don't know something, right? What was striking about the feedback is this wasn't a science problem. Nobody debated with me the evidence of these 5 things on the checklist or whether they should do it. They agreed that we should do it. What they debated was power and politics and culture, that really nasty and important thing that we have to try to get our hands around. So I pulled the doctors and nurses together and said, you know, is it tenable that we harm patients here in our hospital? And everyone says no. And I said, okay, and docs, do you agree that we ought to do this checklist? Yes, Peter, absolutely. It's evidence-based. It's from the CDC. I said, okay, well, then your egos aren't going to get in the way of it happening. So nurses, I need you to speak up. And docs, the nurses are empowered to make sure that we comply with the checklist. Not because it's an ego thing, not because we expect you to be perfect. You have permission to forget to wash your hands. I have permission to forget to wear a cap, but I don't have permission to needlessly put patients at risk. So if I forget, that's okay, I'm human, but if the nurse sees me, I'm going to go back and fix the defect. Not because it's about power, but because it's about the patient. And nurses, I know you're afraid of getting your head bit off, so let me be very clear. If the docs give you flack, you are empowered to page me any time of day or night, and you will be supportive. Docs, if you don't agree with the evidence, let's have a discussion. But you just told me you agree with it, so the only barrier is our egos, and that's not happening. So we put that program in. I was never paged. Compliance went to about 95%. Infection rates fell from 5 to 2. Right? I mean, think we were at 11 to 15, unheard of performance. Good, but still not good enough. So we applied another principle of the science of safety, the first principle being standardized with the line cart, the second principle being create independent checks for things that are important. And we started learning from our defects. So we asked our doctors and nurses to work with the infection preventionists and investigate every one of the infections that we have. What that did was, one, really change the mindset from these infections are inevitable to that they're really preventable. And two, it helped us find where we're going wrong. So what did we find? Well, we found that half of our remaining infections were from catheters that were placed outside of the ICU, in the emergency department, in the operating room, but we hadn't taken our program there. So we went and brought our program there. Infection rates came down to 1. We then found that the few remaining infections we had were all in people who had catheters for a long time. In other words, the infections had nothing to do with catheter insertion, but they had everything to do with catheter maintenance. And what did we do? We then looked at our maintenance practices with the same science, and we found they weren't standardized. Nursing knowledge varied widely, nursing practice varied widely. There was no independent checks, and there was no audit and feedback of how well they were doing. Many times the catheters were hanging off the patient's neck, and they're difficult to keep these dressings on. So we tightened up our maintenance practices, and infections went away. Now, when I say went away, we work in a large academic medical center that cares for quite sick and immunosuppressed patients. And most of our ICUs were well over a year and a half without an infection. I mean, huge improvements over what we had been. So I got a call from the Michigan Hospital Association and said, Peter, would you come and bring your program to Michigan? And to be honest, at first I was pretty reluctant. I said, you know, I'm an academic doc, I'm not really a consultant, and I heard kind of non-verbally or sometimes verbally that I also wasn't so welcome, that this was the infectious disease or infection prevention problem, and what's this critical care doctor doing in my turf, right? And then the academic doctor saying, what's this Hopkins guy doing in our state? You know, we have academics, and we almost didn't do it, but this little voice in the back of my head said, Peter, these infections, bloodstream infections, kill as many people in the U.S. as breast cancer a year. And that's true. It's a little bit less, but it's almost as much as breast cancer. So I'm thinking that there is a public health problem the size of breast cancer for which there's a cure. And it's not my cure. The hospitals have a cure. They just didn't know it yet. And our job was to kind of help them clarify that they do have the cure, that they have the potential. So we went and did it, and we knocked the socks off these infections. Now, the infections, when I say knock the socks off, they were reduced by about 70%, the mean reduction, And the median infection rate went to zero within 6 months of starting this and has now stayed zero for over 4 years. Just unheard of performance. What's interesting is though this got framed as it was only a checklist, it was a whole lot more. And let me talk to you a little bit more about what that intervention is. Those of you who are following, I'm on slide six now. You can think of this as three legs of the stool. There was robust measurement of infections, and that was absolutely essential to give feedback, to monitor our own performance, to hold ourselves accountable. There was a program to improve culture that we call CUSP, the Comprehensive Unit-Based Safety Program, and it's based on the science that culture is local, that if you look within a hospital or a clinic or a health system, each area has its own culture, right? And I'm sure you see that if you just walk into a labor and delivery suite or an accident room or an operating theater or an ICU. They have their own culture. They care about each other. They're the tribe. And they often point fingers out of people outside their tribe, right? It's those floor nurses that, you know, refuse to take our patients or that they are always delaying things. So we designed an intervention to take into account that microsystem and help them do really a number of very simple things. The first part of this CUSP program is to make sure everybody understands the science of patient safety, right? And I say that, and there's a free video on our safercare.net website of what that means. But I'll briefly share it with you what we're talking about. Most doctors and nurses and pharmacists and other allied health professionals are what I would say system blind, that we're not trained to think in systems. Our eyes just haven't been trained to think that broadly. When things go wrong, we blame each other or we blame ourselves, but we don't necessarily take a broad view. I'll give you an example. There was a morbidity and mortality conference that was on national television where we let the TV crews come into a surgery M&M at Johns Hopkins, quite risky, frankly, for our organization. And they were reviewing a case of a delayed transport of a patient from the emergency department to the operating room. It was a trauma victim, and in our hospital, it's an eight-floor elevator ride. And a senior surgeon is asking a visibly shaking junior surgeon, what's he going to do differently next time? And the doctor's response highlights what's so beautiful about medicine and what is often so naive. The doctor said, with his head shaking, I'm going to push harder next time. I'm going to push harder next time. And I watched that and thought, boy, how fortunate are we to have clinicians who care that much. If that doctor had to, he would carry that patient up the stairs. I have no doubt about that. But I also said, how naive. Because I'm not sure about in your hospital, but in my hospital, when a surgeon says, I'm going to push harder, behaviorally, what do you think that translates into? Right? Most likely screaming or a tantrum. Right? Go, 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 go. Not likely to be very effective. Right? A system solution might be, maybe we ought to have the security guard carry a trauma beeper, and when the trauma beeper goes off, their job is to go hold the elevator and don't let it go until the surgeon says, I don't need it anymore. Right? That would be a system solution. But our docs and nurses are system blind. We don't think in systems. We think in my hands and the patients, and that's all the tools I have to work with. So part of the science of safety is for people to develop lenses to see systems, to understand basic principles of safe design, like standardizing, creating independent checks, and learning from mistakes. It's intended to teach basics of communication, and it's intended to help clinicians understand the overwhelming data that clinicians make wise decisions with diverse and independent inputs. So asking a patient or a nurse what their views are doesn't take away my authority. It helps me make better decisions. Okay. The next step of this CUSP program, it's a unit-level team, is to ask staff how the next patient will be harmed. We try to identify defects. We then assign an executive to partner with that team. Some of you may be familiar with executive walk rounds. You can kind of think of this as evidence-based walk rounds or walk rounds on steroids, in that what we know is the more times the executive meets with the staff, the more things the executive fixes or the more harm they reduce, the better the improvement of culture. So in this model, the executive becomes part of that, in this case, ICU team. They roll up their sleeves, they meet with them monthly, and they help review how staff think the next patient's going to be harmed, and they work to fix things. We then ask staff to learn from one defect a month or a quarter, depending on how big the problem is. And we have a very practical method of knowing whether you learned from defect. You can kind of think of it as a mini root cause or analysis or a root cause analysis light. And we say you learned if you can answer four questions. What happened? Why did it happen? What are you going to do to reduce the risk of it happening again? And how do you know you reduced risk? So let me give you a concrete example. In one of our ICUs, we had a mistake where somebody needed transvenous pacing. And to do that, you may know there's a cordis, a catheter that goes into your neck, and it's hollow. And then there's another catheter that has a pacing electrode that goes inside of that. In both the catheter, what's called a cordis, and the pacing wire come in different sizes. And in the supply cabinet, they're all just laid out there. So four different bins, you have to try to grab the right combination. Well, our docs grabbed the wrong combination, quite understandably. It's in the middle of the night, it's dark. The patient got an air embolism and went into PEA arrest, pulseless electrical activity. We resuscitated the patient, and when I was reviewing the case in the morning with the charge nurse said almost with a chuckle, "You know, Peter, I've been here 20 years, and this happens every few months, and I'm sure all of you have errors that recur over and over again. And I think the reason is we're really, really good at recovering from mistakes. So you get an air embolism, I resuscitate you. But we're not very good at learning. And by learning, I mean reducing the risk that future patients will suffer this. So what are we going to change now that it's not likely to happen again?" So I said, okay, that's not acceptable. Let's take out the learning from defect form. And everyone took it out. And we said, okay, I just told you what happened. Why did it happen? What systems were broken? And the nurses were trained on the science of safety, and they clearly said, okay, supervision is inadequate. I say, okay, you're absolutely right. Training is likely inadequate. But most importantly, the supplies are stored in a stupid way. We set our docs up to fail because we require our docs to guess the right size combination rather than just making that easy for them. I said, okay, now you're thinking like a systems person. Perfect. What are you going to do differently to reduce the risk? The nurse said, well, why don't I go tape the right size combination equipment that you need and write four pacing on it so we don't make our docs guess. I said, okay, bingo. That's perfect. Great idea. But that still requires you going in there all the time whenever we get supplies. How are you going to know when you get supplies? Could we do anything stronger, anything that has a greater probability of being effective? The nurse said, well, why don't I develop a survey and ask all of our docs what equipment they need when they do pacing? I'll get consensus on it, and we'll have central supply make up a pacing kit that comes with everything they need, standardization of the equipment. I said, now you're thinking like a system. We did that. How do we know we reduced risk? Our fourth question is I simply walked in the supply cabinet a month later and saw we had the new catheters, right, the new kits there. That we took a 20-year-old problem, relatively limited amount of time, very focused, and reduced risk. Right? Imagine where your organization, your country would be if every one of your units started learning from one defect a month. Last part of this CUSP program is we ask people to implement teamwork tools. You see, when we ask people how the next patient's going to be harmed, the number one answer is teamwork problems. The nurses say, we don't know the plan of care, or we're out of the loop. The doctors often say there's communication problems. But communication problems aren't one behavior. They're a variety of behaviors. And so what we do is if staff say that, we have a conversation with them and say, okay, tell me what behaviors you're talking about. And then we have a matching of what they're concerns are with tools. So if the staff say, hey, Peter, we don't know the plan of care. We just feel like we're out of the loop. I say, maybe we ought to try daily goals form. Great tool to help resolve that problem. Another staff may say, you know, we really don't understand everyone else's role. We don't have role clarity. We say, okay, let's try shadowing. Let's go do someone else's job for a little bit. Just amazing, amazing opportunities to improve teamwork. Okay, that's the CUSP program, and that keeps going. Once you learn from one defect, you learn from more, but it's a unit-based team. Every unit that you're working on to reduce infections needs this team. The third leg of the stool is the what normal is thought of as the checklist, but it's a method to translate evidence into practice. And this leg is used for those types of problems for which there is empiric evidence. You see, one of the things that we learned in this journey of safety is that there's different types of safety problems that require different theories and methods and interventions. So just like at a high level, I could say, I'm going to use the scientific method to study breast cancer, a diagnostic test to study long-term outcomes, or to study a chemotherapeutic agent. At a 30,000-foot level, yes, that is essentially a true statement, but each of those studies would look very differently, right? And it's the same thing with safety. A problem about communication is very different than a problem of putting evidence into practice, i.e. like surgical site infections, where we know there's evidence, we're just not doing it. And so this TRIP model is intended for problems of putting evidence into practice. That is, there's some empiric evidence that says what we should do, and we're just not doing it. So think of pneumonia or ventilator-associated pneumonia, DVT, BSI, SSI, are all things for which this model would apply. And what the model is, it's quite simple. It says summarize what the evidence is into a checklist, right, and link these checklists in time and space. So on ICU admission, this is what the ICU director or the ICU admitting a physician does. Then find the barriers to those, because simply knowing that the checklist is of what to do is really only a small part of the game. We have to make it easy for the clinicians to do that, and our jobs are to find those barriers, go investigate and dissect them. And we find barriers in a number of very practical ways. What I call walk the process. That is, we literally say, what does it take to go place a central line in my shop, and how am I going to do it? Two, we observe someone doing it and seeing where they struggle, what's hard. And three, we go talk to the clinicians and ask them, what's difficult about doing this? How can we make it easier? Next step is we develop some measures of performance, ideally both process, that is, are we using the evidence, and outcomes, the results achieved, and give people feedback on that. And then we make sure that all patients get what this evidence is, because we now know our barriers. And we do that using this model that we call the four E's, and those stand for engage, educate, execute, and evaluate. So engage is, your staff need to know how doing this makes the world better, how your patients benefit. And, you know, saving your trust money often doesn't cut it. It's really about what's the clinical value of for this. And we show that by telling stories and by showing baseline data. We then educate. We try to remove ambiguity. We're saying, okay, these are what the behavior expectations are on the checklist. Let's make sure we're doing them. We then execute. We say, okay, given your local barriers now that you know about, what are you going to do to make sure that you change your work system so that every patient gets that evidence? Every patient gets the evidence. And it might be making a line card. It might be something else. But it's tailored to your local barriers. And then evaluate. At the end of the day, am I getting feedback? Do all of my nurses know my infection rates and week without infections? Do my docs know it? Does my CEO know it? And in this model, we try to what we call create this chain of accountability. Chain of accountability. And what do I mean by that? Well, what we've seen is that there's three different stakeholders within, and this is a simple model, so it may be more complicated in the real world. But think of it as three different stakeholders: senior leaders, team leaders that might be an ICU director, an infection preventionist, and then frontline staff. And to get dramatic reductions, every one of them need to go through those four E's. For those of you who are following, I'm on slide 7. So what we've seen is when CEOs just sign up for a program or some campaign, likely does absolutely nothing. They sign up and it goes away. If frontline staff or an ICU manager signs up for a program but they don't have supportive senior leaders, likewise, it usually fizzles or dies of starvation for resources. To get these to work, all three of this chain need to be connected. Senior leaders have to commit resources and be engaged. Team leaders need to be held accountable for infections, and frontline staff have to actively participate. And if you create that chain of accountability, you'll be well on your way to making dramatic progress. So the results, as I mentioned, are really remarkable. I mean, it's one of the largest and most dramatic improvements. Over 100 ICUs in Michigan reduced their infections by 70%. Culture improved by about 50%, and nobody really thought it was possible to improve culture on such a large scale, but it did. But perhaps most importantly, mortality went down dramatically. And this these data, actually, there a doctoral student in the Hopkins School of Public Health did her thesis with me on this, and we said, well, if we really prevented all these infections in Michigan, did we save lives? And the only database that identifies patients in ICUs in Michigan is Medicare, and it's a database of patients over 65. So we looked at it and showed that, and we compared the mortality of Medicare patients in the whole state of Michigan, the whole state, independent if they were in our program, because we said as a policy-level intervention, some hospitals may not participate. So this is a very conservative analysis. And we compared it to the trends in mortality in similar patients in the 11 surrounding states as the control. And what you can see is over time, there's been an improvement in mortality or a trend in the U.S. So it's why controls are so important. But what you can see is when our project started back in October of 2003, continuing still, the mortality curves separate and they continue to separate. And we think this is the culture impact. So there's a dramatically improved mortality amongst patients in Michigan ICUs compared to the others. Well, we're now taking this program and putting it in state by state across the whole U.S. We've put it in partnership with the World Health Organization through most of Spain and in partnership with the National Patient Safety Agency in the U.K., or I guess what used to be the National Patient Safety Agency in the U.K., across the U.K. And I'll just simply share with you how the U.S. project is organized, because it's similar in each of the countries conceptually, and that is there's what I might call a vertical core. There's a team that provides technical support that helps with measurement, because we need to make sure the measurement is standardized and robust. We don't have clinicians waste their time looking up the evidence. We find the evidence because the evidence is the same around the globe. But then we clearly recognize that individual hospitals know their own barriers. They have their own resources and culture, so they have to tailor the checklist to fit their own needs. So you could think of it as this almost like a fractal. I love the metaphor, which a fractal is a geometric shape with smaller subunits, all of the same shape that fit in a hole. And I think of quality and safety as a fractal, that there's a global infrastructure for safety. There's a national, there's a state or a trust, there's a health system. And then ultimately there's a unit and that doctor, clinician, or nurse patient interaction. Right, and we have to make sure that this knowledge diffuses both ways the whole way. And that's what the beauty of this CUSP program is it gets it to that real world, to that clinician-patient dyad, and yet provides a backbone for support for people to have evidence, to share what they're doing, to have good measurement. I wanted to also show you that this model doesn't just apply to bloodstream infections. We recently published how there was a similar reduction in ventilator-associated pneumonia in over 100 ICUs in Michigan. Same model. Now, VAP is much harder to measure, I'll be the first to admit, and hospitals vary in their measurement. But the point is the approach is exactly the same. Now, I want to share with you, let's broaden the lens so we told the story of these really dramatic reductions. Why does it work? What does it take to get to zero? Is it just the use of this checklist? Well, we borrowed a safety tool from the nuclear industry. After Chernobyl, the nuclear industry realized that internal peer review doesn't work very well, and there's great data to show in healthcare it doesn't work very well either. And external review by regulators often creates a culture of fear. They're needed to keep us honest, but they're not likely to get to significant improvements because of this fear of being judged, so you hide your mistakes rather than learn from them. So what nuclear did was they created peer-to-peer reviews. One nuclear site goes and reviews another. It's confidential. They use validated tools, and you get a confidential report. And the only thing you have to give is, if we go in and see you doing something really good, we'd like you to let us share it with others, right? It's a beautiful model. So we did that for hospitals to reduce bloodstream infections. And we went into hospitals that had high infection rates, those that got to zero. And we found that those who were zero, it wasn't by chance. They did a number of very specific things to get to zero. And I'd like to share those with you. The first they did was the CEO committed publicly to zero and knew the infection rates. If I walked in and interviewed the CEO, which we did as part of this, and they said, oh, my goal is to be low, or, yeah, you know, I don't know what our rates are, but I think they're okay, they were almost guaranteed not to be okay. They were quite high, or at best mediocre. If, on the other hand, like one CEO said, my goal is zero, we've now gone 699 days without an infection, and I count every day, it's not surprising that he's 699 days without an infection. If the ICU leaders, not the infection preventionist, was accountable for the infections and they knew their rates, they were more likely to be zero. So in many hospitals, the ICU docs were checked out. They didn't even know their rates, or I'd walk in and they'd say, yeah, you know, I think we may have had a problem a year ago, but we're okay now. And I don't really know my rates, but I think our infection preventionist has it under control. Guaranteed they weren't low, and they were often quite high. Or the hospital CEO said, oh, yeah, the infection preventionist is the one accountable. And we'd say, yeah, but, you know, I don't think they're the ones who put these catheters in or use them. How could they be accountable? They're not the ones doing the work. They have a vital role in educating and providing evidence and measuring, but switch it to the docs and nurses who do the work. So ICU leaders are accountable. If the ICU made it easy to comply with the checklist, what do I mean by that? Well, if the equipment was available, I can't tell you the number of hospitals I walked in and the managers would say, oh, yes, Peter, we have a line cart. And when I walked up around the ICU, the staff there would say, well, yeah, we have a piece of junk in the corner, but the wheels don't work, or it's never stocked, or it's not stocked with the right things. They didn't get ground truth. They didn't go find the barriers. And so not surprisingly, it didn't work. ICUs that were zero made sure the nurses were empowered to stop takeoff. That is, they were empowered to say, we have a culture that we will guarantee patients get evidence-based practice, and if the docs don't do it, the nurses could speak up. Now, nobody believes that just having a policy to support nurses speaking up is enough to change culture. But over and over, the nurses tell me that it gives them comfort knowing there's an official policy. So if a doctor has a cow about this or yells about this, they're not going to get fired because they're backed by a policy. And I think that's really important. The ICUs that were zero investigated every infection as a defect. They dug into it. They looked why it happened. They looked where the catheter was placed. And they tried to tease out whether it was an insertion or a maintenance problem. The longer the catheter was in, the more likely it was maintenance. That's not a perfect separation, but at least it helps guide you. They also standardized and audited catheter maintenance. So they applied the same principles to catheter maintenance, and they posted and discussed their infection rates and week without infections. So that, in my estimation, is the trick to get to zero. If those things happen, hospitals are at zero. If any one of them is missing, they may come down, but they won't get that dramatic results. So I think about, why did this project work? Well, one was, we started with the goal of reducing infections and worked backwards. I didn't care about finding the independent impact of whether my checklist could be 5 items or 4 or 3 or 2 or 1. What I cared about was that we reduced these infections that are killing as many people as breast cancer. So we focused on that. Next is that we kept score with measures clinicians believed were valid. So much of our effort, we collect data on measures that doctors and nurses just don't believe, and they're often, frankly, right not to believe, but we wonder why we don't make progress. Well, of course, we didn't make progress. Doctors don't believe it works. We were guided by science, good science about how to prevent these infections, and we modified to fit the local context. That is, it's important for you to separate the evidence-based practices from implementing those practices. The evidence-based practices are often global around the world. This is what we know about reducing infections. The implementation of those practices has to be tailored to local context. Right? You can't micromanage describing how to implement it. Even within Johns Hopkins, every unit implements differently because they have different needs and resources and culture, but they all have to implement. They're accountable for doing it. But importantly, and this is a lesson I learned from my sociology colleagues in the UK, Mary Dixon Woods, is that they believe, and I think they're right, that the main reason Michigan worked was that we framed this issue as a social problem that is capable of being solved. You see, too often we write off these infections as inevitable rather than preventable because there's no one clinician's role who causes it. There's many. And while clinicians are often very accountable for their own individual piece of the work, we don't have good accountability mechanisms for things like infections that are across many different types of clinicians and often care areas. And in this project, we said, no, you're responsible for infections, and you're capable of getting to zero. And I think once that belief happens, clinicians are smart enough to just run with it and figure out what to do. So let's talk a few minutes about what did we learn about checklists in particular. Well, I would encourage you to see, and hopefully this story told it, that checklists are an important component, but only one component of a broader intervention, like our model to put evidence-based into practice. That I wouldn't think of doing a program of checklists, say, to reduce pneumonia without cusp, because culture change is key. It won't work without culture change. Or I wouldn't think of doing it without identifying the barriers. So just summarizing the checklist is great, but then I got to think like an anthropologist or a sociologist and go find out the barriers. We also learned that checklists seem to be effective when they're linked in time and space. That is, making an overall checklist doesn't seem to work very well, but rather what's worked very well is saying, okay, on admission to the ICU with the catheter, this is what I do. Or when I'm rounding every day for catheter maintenance, this is what I do. But trying to make checklists that span time or locations are often hard because there's different clinicians doing them, so keep them focused. I would make sure your checklists are as unambiguous as possible. When we look at, I mentioned you, barriers to using evidence-based practices, we published a little tool called the Barrier Identification Tool, and we group barriers, at least in this model, into 3 big categories. Provider barriers, that is, they may not know the evidence or they may not agree with it. Guideline barriers or checklist barriers, that is, the checklist itself is not clear about what exactly am I to do, when, where, and how. And third, system barriers. Okay, I know that I should do this. I accept the evidence. It's clear what I'm supposed to do, but it's just hard. I can't – it's not easy to do here. And amongst those guideline barriers, ambiguity is the main one. So when you look at your checklist, make sure that you, when you read it, you're crystal clear about what is the behavior that you want, who's supposed to be doing it, and when and how are they doing it. And if you're not clear, then you need to make sure that you focus on that. Next thing is what I call get ground truth, right? Don't just assume because you hand your docs these checklists that all is all hunky-dory, or even if you have a line cart. Go find out, is it really meeting the clinician's needs? Talk to the clinicians. Understand what's working for them and what's not working for them. And then, lastly, encourage local adaptation. You know, I laugh because people say, oh, can I see the Michigan checklist? And I say, well, there were 100 ICUs in this program. There's 100 variations of the checklist. Now, they're all 99% the same, but that 1% variation is absolutely key if you're going to get local buy-in. And every one of them thinks theirs is the best, and the reality is the best for their context and culture. So make it better. Let them flex it. We don't give on what the evidence-based practices are, right? Every patient will get those five items, but how they get it, what the implementation looks like, varies by context and culture. And that differentiation is really important and often overlooked in quality improvement work. And it's, without it, you're not going to make much progress. But, you know, I'll end with what I found was the biggest barrier to getting to zero, by far the biggest barrier. And that is whether you believe that it's really possible. Because what we've seen is as we go to change these programs, as you go to do this work, as I go to do this work, that little voice in the back of my head says, Peter, who do you think you are to be doing this? Right? What are you, crazy? You think you're going to reduce infections in a whole state of Michigan? Now in a whole country, where do you come off thinking that, right? When nobody wants to do this, and we all have this self-doubt, or even leading in my own unit, you know, I'm going to get pushback from the doctors, or my administrator is not going to support me. And if we listen to that doubt, we won't succeed. But I use the story, I remind you of what happened in 1956 when Roger Bannister broke the four-minute mile. Now, some of you may remember that record of the four-minute mile stood for 2,000 years. 2,000 years is one of the longest running records. And indeed, many leading doctors and scientists at the time said it was physiologically impossible to break the four-minute mile. You would die. There was literally quotes saying, it's not possible for the human body to do this. It would kill you. And then came Roger Bannister, who perhaps didn't listen to them, didn't hear that little nagging voice, and he broke the four-minute mile. Many of you may know that story. Roger was a medical student at the time in England. What you may not know is this 2,000-year-old record, remember, 2,000 years. The year after Roger broke it, 15 people broke it. The year after that, I think the number was around 156. And now you're not even a competitive runner if you're not well below the four-minute mile. Indeed, in many high school students now are breaking the four-minute mile. And so I ask us to say, wow, what changed in 1956 that allowed us to go from a 2,000-year-old record to being relatively commonly broken? I'm not saying it's an easy record to, but now 2,000 years, no one did it. Now hundreds of people, or now thousands of people have done it. And I've come to the conclusion that the only thing that changed was their belief that it was possible. See, I don't think there was blood doping or steroids. At least there's no evidence. It wasn't likely evolution. 2 years is way too short for evolution. It wasn't like my kids would tell me that they got new sneakers and they could run faster. No, I think the only thing that changed was their belief of whether it was possible, because what Roger Bannister did when he broke the four-minute mile is he freed up all of us to go break that four-minute mile ourselves, and many have. And in this area of quality and safety and infections, we are asking you to break this four-minute mile. I think Sorrell King's mother is expecting you to do it. The patients of the hospitals and health systems where you work are expecting it. And I'm confident that you'll be able to give them an answer and be able to provide Sorrel King with a resounding yes to her question, is Josie less likely to die? So I'll end with a request that you fill out the rest of that sentence, I will. And whatever you write down, you go back and do it in your health systems, in your hospitals. I thank you. And for those of you who are interested in this story, it's summarized in my book, Safe Patient, Smart Hospital. So if you want more of the gory details, it's there. And I wish you well in your journey to make care safer for your patients. Thank you and have a great afternoon.
Peter, thank you so much. I'm sure that I speak on behalf of everybody listening now and those who are yet to listen in the future in just, you know, saying a heartfelt thank you and extending our thoughts on the value that you're making towards this specialty of infection prevention and control. And I'd like also to thank the sponsors of this session, again, Virox, and thank you to everybody who's listening for joining us today. If you have any questions for Dr. Pronovost, then please would you email info@weathertraining.com. And I hereby close this teleconference. Thank you once again, everybody, and goodbye.